proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the No Boring Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live today from Washington, D.C. XM Radio kindly loaning us the use of their studios. On Thursday, the Supreme Court ruled, this is a week ago actually, in the case of Davenport versus Washington Education Association, it determined that the First Amendment prohibits public sector unions from using objecting non-members' fees for ideological purposes such as election campaigns. Harry Binswanger is with us with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. The Ayn Rand folks, the thinkers behind the objectivism, the objectivist movement, and thus ultimately the libertarians and modern day conservatives. Although Harry, I realize you are neither libertarian nor conservative; you are an objectivist. Hey, Barry.
Right. Hi, Tom.
And Harry, you're also a member of the board of directors of the Ayn Rand Institute, I should say. This is a big deal. I mean, we're going to have John Sweeney on the program a little later on. Card check is coming up. The ability of people to easily join unions, we've seen ever since 1947 with the passage of Taft-Hartley, more and more barriers to union membership. And it appears to me from this op-ed that what you're suggesting is that union members should not, that unions should not be allowed to use union dues for basically any kind of political activity. Am I reading this right?
First of all, I can only speak for myself, and I think that unions should be allowed to use their money for ideological activities and for supporting political candidates. I frankly neglected to read that op-ed, but I can tell you what the objectivist philosophy holds, which is that all contractual relationships are valid if not coercively reached, that all relations should be voluntary by contract. So, therefore, if people agree to join a union freely without coercion, then they can use their dues for whatever peaceful purpose they choose. Now, I know today there's a lot of legislation giving special coercive powers to unions so that people in closed shops and so forth are virtually coerced into joining. But the solution to that is not to further restrict union power, but to repeal the special privileges they got in the first place and return to a laissez-faire capitalist situation.
But the fact of the matter is, without those what you're calling special privileges, in the case of closed shops, everybody has to join. Everybody's getting the benefits of the union. Without those so-called special privileges, you won't have unions. I mean, you know, they will have no power.
Yeah, that's
something.
Right.
Something probably has to be able to balance the power of organized capital.
Well, see, that's a basically different conception that you're working from. Under the ideas that ground capitalism, economic power is sharply distinguished from political power. Economic power is just the power of capital, is just the power to make offers, the power to say if you want to have this value, for instance, this job, then you need to give me something in return that we can voluntarily agree on. Political power is the power to throw somebody in jail, to ultimately to execute him, to take his life, to fine him.
Right. So the bottom line is what you're saying is that the purpose of an economy, the reason why we have capitalism, is, or let me rephrase that, the purpose of society is to serve capitalism rather than the other way around.
No, I'm saying precisely the opposite, that there should be no coercive political privileges given to labor or capital, and that both should be able to meet in the free market
but there is no such thing as a free market. The market by government. The rules of the market are created by government.
Well,
the laws
today,
allow capital to aggregate are created by government. All of that stuff is created by government. That marketplace exists, and you're saying you want to have all those rules in place and all those laws and courts to enforce those laws and police to enforce those laws and prisons to enforce the lawbreakers.
Mm-hmm.
You want to have all of that stuff that you call the free market that's actually the creation function of government. You want to have all of that stuff protecting capital and capitalists, but you don't want to have similar protections for labor.
I want to have exactly identical protections for labor. The government,
but labor isn't capital, so you can't have rules that protect capital are not going to protect labor.
No, I think we should have rules that protect both, but they should be neither.
Well, that's what I'm talking about here. Rules that protect labor are.
Let me get something out here.
Sure.
Either we're talking about individual rights, which the government does protect. Or we're talking about some non-equal special privileges to balance against so-called exploitation. Now, I'm in favor of every individual having exactly the same rights, the right to freedom, property, life, and the pursuit of happiness. And the government does protect them. The government does underwrite.
No, but you're advocating for rights beyond that. You're advocating for every individual to have the right to be a capitalist, to participate in the use of capital.
And not to be.
However, you're saying that those people who choose rather to be labor than to be capital, they should have a different set of rights.
They should have
no rights.
I don't know where that from. I'm saying exactly the opposite. I'm saying that everybody has rights, whether he's a capitalist or a laborer, and they're exactly the same.
So if a union goes on strike,
yeah.
if all the people in a union go on strike,
right.
and the law says that the company cannot replace them with replacement workers, they have to negotiate with that union, you consider that to be a course of law, correct?
Right. Absolutely.
Okay, so that's a right that you don't think labor should have.
I don't think anyone should have that.
Okay, and see, my point is that law that protects labor, that again, we're simply establishing the rules of the game of the marketplace here. Mm-hmm. That rule that protects labor is really functionally no different than the law that says that if you, Harry Binswanger, and I decide that we're going to create a corporation, that we have limited liability from lawsuits, that if we run up a huge debt, we can declare bankruptcy and walk away from it, or the corporation can, and we have no personal involvement with it, that if the corporation kills somebody, we're not going to go to jail. I mean, there are a whole bunch of rights, or privileges, actually, I would suggest these are, that we grant to the corporate form, and yet you don't want to grant rights or privileges, let's say, to labor.
Okay.
And I don't get it.
Well, let me explain it to you. The issue of corporations, I'm happy to discuss, but I don't think that's your issue, because if it were a sole proprietorship, you wouldn't allow a sole proprietorship to have the, quote, unequal bargaining power that a corporation does. Now, a corporation, it just to take
sure.
up that point, well,
sure
would
could.
You? Go ahead.
Well, no, I mean, if a sole proprietorship owned a business mm-hmm. that had a union and that union went on strike,
mm-hmm.
then I think that the union's rights to strike should be protected. Labor's rights should be protected. If you're going to have a marketplace, in my opinion, the purpose of the marketplace is to serve society, not the other way around. And what you're suggesting is that the purpose of the marketplace is basically to serve those who own the marketplace, which is capital and capitalists.
The purpose, the marketplace doesn't really have a purpose. It's just to...
Then why did we bring it into existence?
We don't. We bring into existence individual rights, including property rights. We don't bring them into existence.
We brought this marketplace into existence. There's hundreds of thousands of pages of laws on the books. You know, lawyers, accountants, CPAs. There's all this stuff people you know study and learn how to use,
yes.
manipulate, participate in the so-called free market that is actually the creation of government.
No, but the government in a free market merely protects the rights of individuals. It doesn't create anything. What happens is I own a house, let's say, and you own your body. And I say to you, look, would you like to use your body to help me clean my house? And if you do, I'll give you some of my corn. And the government only comes in to protect that voluntary agreement and to say I can't coerce you, I can't
no,
or, beat you up.
No, actually, it goes way beyond that. You know, what if you know I clean your house and you don't give me the corn? I mean, you know,
yeah,
then there has to be
right.
some remedy. That's where
right.
the laws come into place, and that's where
that's
I'm
right.
saying that the marketplace is an artificial construct. It's a societal agreement, and that agreement should include protections of labor as well as capital.
Do you think it's an artificial construct that if I get you to do something for me with a contract to give you corn and then I don't give it, it's artificial to make me give back the corn that's really yours? That's a protection of property. That's not artificial. That's a protection of property.
It's an agreement. It's a social consensus that has been converted into law.
Rights, individual rights by man's nature and requirements as a living being.
Okay, interesting conversation. Harry Binswanger. IonRand.org. Good talking with you today, Harry. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartmann radio program broadcasting live from Washington, D.C. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartmann, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio.
There's a certain comfort to know that the promises made will be kept by the government. You don't have to worry.
That's good, because I work three jobs and I feel like I contribute.
You work three jobs?
Three jobs, yes.
Uniquely American, isn't it? I mean, that is fantastic that you're doing that.
Thank you.
You get any sleep?
As Mr. President, the world you live in is a little different than the world we live in, all the rest of us, which, by the way, pardon me, was the point that Hillary Clinton made this morning, a speech at the Senate, at the Take Back America conference. I heard her speech. It was really interesting. I'll tell you more about it as we go on through the day, but she was talking about how all the invisible people, the people that are invisible to the Republicans, and actually she was saying they were invisible to Bush and his buddies, and which I thought was a mistake, because we're not running against Bush, you know, and really we should be saying that they're invisible to the Republicans, but nonetheless, it was a pretty good speech, pretty good speech. Pretty down the middle speech. I'd say it was the kind of speech that she could have done for a national audience just as well as for the base. I think she's getting, you know, she's not going to say anything to the base that could be used against her in the national election. So, but anyway, and one of the points that she talked about is the need to bring back unions, to re-empower unions. There was one point when she was actually booed. And that was when she said that I'm paraphrasing wildly here. I'm sure we'll have the audio a little later, that part of the problem in Iraq was the Iraqis' failure, an Iraqi failure. And people actually booed her on that. But anyhow, by the way, just a quick heads up, our contest to give away a copy of Screwed, the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class and What We Can Do About It, my new book, to the best post to the blog today over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartmann page. Go over there and click on the blog, and whoever posts what, in David Poole's opinion, is the most thoughtful and interesting commentary will receive a copy of the book. So we'll be checking that out. And I'm working from an unfamiliar studio. Whoops, and I just lost my window. Here we go. It's coming back. So 1-866-303-2270, our number, Jack in Northridge, California. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. I really, really enjoy your show. I just wanted to comment on the last caller, or at least the last one that I heard.
My guest, Harry Binswanger.
And two things. One is just in general, his remarks reminded me of the comment of Anatole France, that the law in its infinite wisdom forbids the rich and the poor alike from sleeping under bridges. It's no great thing to say that the law should be the same for everybody. The law should take into account the differences in people's life situations and be fairly aimed at the needs of people who live, rather than fairly aimed at abstractions of intellectuals.
Well, that was my point. Is the economy here to serve society, or are we here to serve the economy and those who basically control and run it?
Right.
And that's basically the conservative-liberal divide. You know, the conservative position is that the rabble, as John Adams, the first conservative president of the United States, yes, referred to people like you and me, that the rabble is here to serve the interests of wealth and power and the institutions,
yes,
that hold it. And Thomas Jefferson, our first really aggressively liberal president who followed Adams, flipped it upside down and said, no, it's the other way around. He said, I don't look to the rich for the salvation of this country. I look to the average working person.
As did Lincoln, if you'll recall. Lincoln said,
oh, yeah,
that labor precedes wealth.
Yeah, he said, his actual quote is, labor is superior to capital because labor,
right,
precedes capital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One thing I would add, again, just sort of in general to this libertarian conservative mindset, which is that although they insist that everyone should be able to seek their own self-interest, in reality, they won't concede that you and I and other people, what I like to think of as the people in the herd rather than the people, the lions, they insist that the people in the herd have essentially a moral obligation to run away and abandon the weakest and the relatively financially or for whatever other sense unempowered.
Right.
To abandon them to be eaten. And the first time anyone in the herd says no, the smart, enlightened, self-interest thing for the herd is to band together to protect ourselves. Then the libertarians are all, oh, God, no, that's a misuse of the law. And I just respond, no, that's me pursuing my enlightened self-interest.
That's right. And in fact, that's how it's done in virtually every other animal society on Earth. I mean, there are a few animals out there that are basically loners, but we're social animals, and just like every other social animal, we have egalitarianism built into us. We have the instinct of family and clan and tribe and community built into us. We have the instinct of looking out for each other. Jack, thanks a lot for the call. Well said. This is part of the human condition. This is part of human nature. This is part of who we are. And to revert back to the days of the robber barons, and it's so destructive to America, frankly, to the United States. 27 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Keep my nose on the grindstone, work hard every day. I might get a little tired on the weekend. After I draw my pay, I'll go back working. Come Monday morning, I'm right back with the crew. I drank a little beer that evening, sang a little bit of these working man blues.
And welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 34 and a half minutes. Coming up on 35. China has cut and in some cases abolished export rebates. This is on the front page of the Financial Times today. I didn't even know China was offering export rebates. They have a value-added tax, essentially, in China. It runs around 15%, 14.5%. And what they've been doing, or 17.5%, excuse me. And what they've been doing is offering to transnational corporations that export products out of China into the United States and other countries a rebate on this tax. It's we're like, oh yeah, free trade, it's just fine, you know, everybody will play by the same rules. No, it would be sort of like the federal government saying to, you know, any American company, okay, we're gonna rebate all the taxes that you paid. Because the value-added tax, is the VAT, is the primary way that the Chinese government is acquiring tax revenue from corporations. And so, you know, it would be like the U.S. government saying to any kind of manufacturer, to Microsoft, to General Motors, well, we're gonna just do away with all your taxes, by the way, if you're exporting. And, you know, you could argue that if you wanted to create an export-driven economy, it would be a good thing. It would wipe out some of your revenues. But China has been doing this. They're gonna trim it back now. So an interesting first start. John Podesta is with us. John Podesta is the president and chief executive officer of the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Hey, John.
Tom, how are you?
I'm great. Great to have you here on the program. The coping with foreclosures. Homeowners need help. This actually there are so many issues on our plate right now. Let me just toss this to you. What do you see? What's at the top of your stack right now in terms of issues?
Well, I think that you raised one, but I think it's kind of the tip of the iceberg, which is the pressure on the middle class right now, based on an economy in which real wages aren't growing and the cost of everything's going up. I think that on the top of our agenda are a couple of things. One is, how do you get affordable quality health care for everyone? You know, we're working really hard on trying to get more resources and more innovation into fixing the American public education system, and we're of course paying a lot of attention to the energy legislation that's on the floor and how we can move to a low-carbon energy future. That's on the domestic side. Of course, a preoccupation for us is continues to be, how do we get the U.S. ground forces out of Iraq and get American national security restored?
Yeah, I'm betting that Bush is going to do that before the next election.
Well,
you want to take
we're
the
betting
bet?
That we were going to do it before 2004, and he seems to, I think after the 2006 election with the Baker-Hamilton Commission reporting, there was some chance that, you know, I think they kind of threw him a lifeline and he decided to go the other way. So I think if he's going to do it, is there only going to be under tremendous pressure from the public and from the Congress, including members of his own party in Congress.
Well, that's my point. I, in my opinion, what's going to happen is that the Republicans are going to start saying, "Okay, time to get out." They're going to take credit for it. They're going to take. You know, the Americans are going to be by November of 08. Americans are going to be feeling good that we finally ended that occupation and ended it in some sort of reasonably positive way, or at least wound it down to the point where we don't feel horrible about it. And the big issue, which drove the Democratic victory in 2006, is not going to be available to the Democrats in 2008, in my opinion. I hope I'm wrong.
Well, I don't know. I think I hope you're right.
No, I mean, I hope I'm right that the war ends very quickly. I hope I'm wrong that the Republicans will be able to use it politically.
Yeah, my guess is, though, that the at the end of the day and in reality, that you know, the president seems to have an uncanny ability not to learn anything over time, and he seems to just want to I think it's one thing if he wanted to keep pounding his own head into the wall, but he's pounding the American public's head into the wall, and certainly the men and women in our military into the wall. And so, again, I think I certainly want to urge all your listeners to keep the pressure on to try to make change in Iraq.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, and particularly your blog, ThinkProgress.org, which is a great resource I use in this program on a regular basis and refer to it frequently on the air, because it's just you guys are doing such great work getting the word out. And I'm curious, we've seen ever since Lee Atwater first came up with the idea of working the refs, you know, back during the Reagan years working the media, working the press, calling people out on you know what they saw as outrages or whatever. Really, it hasn't been done on our side, on the Democratic side or on the left, until you guys came along, and now we've got all these guys on the right, you know, foaming at the mouth about the organizations like the Center for American Progress and Media Matters and whatnot. Yesterday or the day before, I guess it was Monday. I read part of it on the air. The RNC, I'm on their mailing list. You know, as a talk show host, I get the daily talking points for the conservative talk show hosts every day, and the major daily talking point was that, you know, the Campaign for America's Future and the had put together this conference in Washington D.C. where I was broadcasting from yesterday and the day before, and I was there this morning for Hillary Clinton's talk, you know, they were seeing it as like some kind of horrible thing. There's this horrible liberal conspiracy now to influence the media. Oh my God, we can't have that. To what extent is the Center for American Progress now solid, and to what extent do you see others coming along? Because the right, I mean, the right has a multi-billion dollar infrastructure that goes back all the way to the founding of the Heritage Foundation and before. This is just the left seems like, it, to me, it's in its infancy.
Yeah.
Or am I missing something?
No, no, I think you're exactly right. I think that what happened on the left is that, you know, largely because of this was a strategy by the mainstream foundations, they funded a lot of groups that were doing good work, but really operating in a kind of single-issue zone, if you think of it. You know, environmental groups or whatever, they felt more comfortable doing that. But what that left was no one really to kind of fight from the center-left perspective against the right-wing propaganda that was coming across the board on everything from national security to economics to, you know, making the world safe for rich people. And I think that that what's happened, I think, in the last couple of years is a bunch of new organizations have started, existing organizations have strengthened, and I think the landscape on our side of the political spectrum now is much deeper and stronger, and I think people see the power of that, not only in the ability to kind of to push back on the Bush administration and the right wing, but also in terms of generating new ideas and bolder visions for reform in this country about how we can create more opportunity for our citizens, create an economy that's growing jobs again, and create an economy that's based on a cleaner environment and tackling the problem of global warming. And create a fairer society. So I think there's, it's the combination of engaging in the public dialogue in the media, but also trying to do the serious analysis and come up with a strong momentum for change that we really need.
One of the phenomena that I find really interesting, we're talking with John Podesta. He's the president and chief executive officer of the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org and ThinkProgress.org. One of the phenomena that really impressed me is the reinvention of, you know, Thomas Paine. Common Sense was originally published anonymously. Ben Franklin was, and this was mentioned last night, in fact, at the awards dinner at the Take Back America conference. Ben Franklin was blogging, as it were. You know, he was doing editorials under a whole variety of phony names, about half of them female. Rusticus. We still don't know who Rusticus was. He's the guy who wrote the pamphlets that were nailed to houses and trees all over Boston in the weeks leading up to the Boston Tea Party that arguably created the Boston Tea Party. They were the bloggers of their era. They didn't go away. I mean, this continued through the Civil War, this kind of thing. In the 60s when I was active in the campus and SDS and whatnot, it was pamphleteering. You know, we'd just, you know, print off a couple hundred copies and run around and pass them out to people, put things up. Now we call them bloggers. And it seems like on the left, the bloggers are active and they're out there and they're talking about real issues and they're exposing real crimes that are being done by this administration. It seems like on the right, the blogosphere is more just kind of sitting around and whining. Is that a totally partisan perspective, or is there some accuracy to that?
No, I think that, you know, we've democratized the media because I think the mainstream media failed the country so badly, and I think that's really a great thing.
I think the mainstream media has turned so right, John. You've got like Glenn Beck on CNN that the left wing blogosphere is just the balance for it.
Right. I think that I just finished up a panel on the imperial presidency and with Marcy Wheeler and Joe Connison and others, and I think that what's happened now is that we've been able to figure out a mode and a means of connecting people with ideas, people who will go in and actually do investigations, get that information out. And so the internet, the blogosphere, has been a tremendous tool for, I think, balancing the voice in America. And, you know,
I have to wrap it up, but you guys are doing a great job with it, too. John Podesta, the Chief Executive Officer and President of the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org. Thanks, John. Great talk.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio.
Working on vacation all the summer long, doing some
content's relaxing just to keep our country strong. I've been seeing Condoleezza, Donald Rumsfeld too. Fox News said I'm still the greatest, so I guess it must be true. Iraq is going well, liberal doesn't sell, Bolton's in New York. I sit back and beam, Roberts is supreme, my revenge for Bork. Someone's been removing some brushweed. That's some.
Enough of that, George. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, my goodness, my goodness, my goodness. First of all, Lauren, I'm assuming, Chris, that Eric Lotke is not with us. No, okay, great. Joe in New York City. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, love your show. You and Randy do a great job back to back.
Thank you. I agree. She's wonderful.
Yeah, she is. Just wanted to discuss one thing. I got home last night, went on the net, and I saw that the internet was a buzzing last night. I mean, there's no secret about it. I love Ron Paul. I think, you know, he's going to be my guy. And I got to read that all his supporters were up in arms last night that he was excluded from the Iowa tax debate that was going to be happening on the 30th of June. Now, the thing that kills me about this is the guys that he's running against have lower numbers than him in the so-called polls. So
right.
It goes to show me that, you know, I believe he's polling way higher than what they're telling us. I think they really, you know, they're censoring the man on purpose because of his message.
Sure. Well, you know, what's going on with Ron Paul is that part of his message really resonates with the American people, which is that, you know, get out of Iraq now. It's stupid. It's wrong. You know, all those kinds of things. Other parts of his message that, you know, just don't, nobody talks about. I mean, he's been a guest on this program a couple of times over the years, and we've talked about him. But, for example, he thinks that we should do away with Social Security. It's, you know, it's just the government should not do that. He doesn't think that labor unions should have rights. He's a libertarian. I mean, that's the bottom line. Libertarians are Republicans who want to smoke dope and get laid. That's Ron Paul. And so, you know, I think that the Republican Party is shooting itself in the foot by excluding him. But, you know, it's, we'll see. It's sort of like Mike Gravel on the Democratic side. You know, he and Dennis Kucinich, you know, speaking out in ways that make the rest of the party kind of uncomfortable.
But I got to ask you this thing. I mean, the thing with
sure.
Ron Paul is that the message that he's starting to talk about, last week he introduced legislation to abolish the Federal Reserve, okay?
Right.
Now, they are the reason for the inflationary tax. And once people understand that and how it affects their pocketbooks, they will listen to his message even 3, 4, 5, 10 times as much as they're listening to it now. And they fear this man, the establishment. Ron Paul has a lot to say, and he's the true patriot out there, Tom.
Yeah, well, I don't disagree that he has a lot to say, and Joe, thanks a lot for the call. And I don't agree, and I don't disagree that he's a patriotic guy. He really loves his country, and doing away with the Fed might be a good idea. I'm just not sure what we'd replace it with. We went through that in this country for over 100 years, and just, you know, a whole series of boom and bust cycles. And I say that not in defense of the Fed. I think probably a whole lot of bright light and fresh air would be a little healthier thing. Phil in Tampa Bay, Florida. Hey, Phil.
Hi, how you doing?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, one issue you didn't discuss when you were interviewing the other people is what it's like when the government acts in behalf of the wealthy. For example, Jeb Bush in the state of Florida, and now his successor, they represent the interests of the wealthy over the interests of everyone else. Let me give you a perfect example. The last thing that Jeb Bush did is he signed a bill that he wanted, which he eliminated an intangible tax that only affected the wealthy. Did not the part of the intangible tax that affected Joe Blow when he buys a house and has to pay a tax on the mortgage, okay, he left that in.
Sure.
But for the people who are trading stocks, he pulled that out.
Well, now, it's just like what his brother did with the last tax cut, where they said if you make your living sitting on your butt around the pool waiting for the dividend check to arrive, you pay a maximum 15% income tax, whereas if you make your living working, you may pay a maximum of 33%, 34%.
Exactly. The other thing that Jeb Bush did is he eliminated the Florida Department of Labor. It doesn't
exist. That's interesting. Altogether?
What we have, okay, what he's done, he restructured it called the Center for Workforce Innovation. And what it does is it finds low-waged workers for new companies. But if your employer, one of the many fly-by-night companies, closes its doors and doesn't give you your last check, you're out of luck. There's no one to go to other than an attorney.
Amazing. Amazing.
Another example. I got a 7-year-old Camaro. Last month it cost me $68 to get a new license plate. If I had gone up to DMV with a 2007 Ferrari, it would have cost me $39.
Yeah, amazing. Phil, thanks a lot for the call. It's just, yes. Welcome to America. And that's why we need to take it back. Pat in Granite Falls, Washington. Hey, Pat, got about a minute before we've got to wrap up this hour. What's up?
Oh, really? I better do this quick. All right. Now, my concern is about the protection of the Constitution and how the Constitution was set aside when the Supreme Court elected our president. Clearly, the Constitution says that the people, the citizens elect the president, and history is going to record that the great damage this has done. The Supreme Court should have sent that back to the people.
They should have sent it back to Florida, where the Florida Supreme Court had ruled that every single vote should be counted, and if every single vote was counted in Florida, then Al Gore would have been our president in 2000. And what's so bizarre about that case is that in Bush v. Gore, it was a lawsuit brought by George Bush, and thank you, by the way, for the call. It was by George Bush, in which he was claiming, get this, I mean, you can go back and read the case. He was claiming that if the vote count continued, he, personally, George W. Bush, would suffer irreparable harm. And the Supreme Court ruled that he was right, which means they ruled that he would have lost. 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception on Air America Radio. Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Well, the new lawyer for the CIA has some strange notions. First of all, he doesn't like talking about what they're doing, even though the president himself will talk about it in public. Things like rendering people to foreign countries. We are becoming a country of the disappeared. Again, to paraphrase Hillary Clinton's talk this morning, she was talking about how there are all these invisible people in America. The one thing she didn't discuss, as I recall, that frankly I think a lot of us are very concerned about, is the actual disappearance of people. Disappearance, not just that Bush doesn't know that, and it's not even Bush, not even just that the Republican Party, the conservatives in general, don't realize the extent of the destruction of the American middle class. The numbers are mind-boggling. I mean, you know, the average family income in the last 5 years has gone down $1,600 on average per family, or $1,500 per family, and yet at the same time productivity is up. It's up almost 20%, which means that people are working harder and they're making less. So as Hillary Clinton pointed out this morning, but the actual disappearing of people. Are people being snatched off the streets of the United States and other countries and then taken to other countries where they are tortured? Right now, as far as we can tell, there's almost 40 people absolutely unaccounted for. I mean, absolutely unaccounted for. Like, probably died while being tortured, unaccounted for. And so the CIA has to hire a new lawyer, new general counsel. And John Rizzo is the guy that Bush has nominated. And he's up before Congress. He was up before Congress yesterday, as I recall. And there was this memo that the Assistant Attorney General Jay Bybee, or the guy who was then the Attorney Assistant General, talked about the definition of torture. And this came out of some of Gonzalez's Gonzo's work on all this stuff. That it's only torture if it's equivalent in intensity to the pain accompanying serious physical injuries such as organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or even death. So, you know, ripping somebody's fingers and nails out, that's not torture. Shackling somebody to a freezing concrete floor for days at a time and not letting them move and having them sleep in their own excrement, that's not torture. That's not equivalent to the pain of major organ failure. So, Carl Levin and Ron Wydner interviewing this guy before Congress, and this is truly mind-boggling. It starts out, I believe this is Carl Levin, it starts out with, and then it goes to Ron Wydner. Here, let me just play this audio for you.
Have detainees been rendered by us, including the CIA, to countries that use torture?
That's an important question. The only way I could give it a proper answer would be in a classified section.
You can't even answer an unclassified. I'm not asking you which countries. I'm just asking you whether we've ever rendered detainees to countries which use torture.
Well, again, if you don't mind, Senator, it's difficult to give a yes or no answer to that in an open session. I would just greatly prefer to give it the attention it deserves in our closing.
So then Carl Levin puts the point on it here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I ask unanimous consent that a statement of the President in December of 2005 that we do not render to countries that torture, a statement made in public, be inserted in the record at this point, in contrast to Mr. Rizzo's statement that he could not answer that question in public.
So here we have President saying, no, we don't render people to countries that practice torture. We don't do that in public, saying that. But the lawyer for the CIA, or the guy who is up to be nominated for the lawyer for the CIA, he's not going to agree with George W. Bush, probably because he doesn't want to be convicted of perjury. Bush wasn't under oath, other than his oath of office when he apparently lied to us, now that the evidence is out. So anyhow, Ron Wyden then continues the questioning on this, and this is fascinating. And notice the pregnant pauses in this, where Rizzo, you just see this guy. He's an attorney, and he's going to become the attorney for the CIA. And the gears are just rolling in his mind about, you know, okay, what do I say about this? How do I handle this? Here, it starts out with Ron Wyden.
We're clear on this Bybee Amendment, because I know a number of colleagues have asked about it. The key part of that memo is the question of inflicting physical pain and it not being torture unless the pain is equivalent to organ failure and the related circumstances. Do you think you should have objected at the time?
I honestly, I can't say I should have objected at the time. I read the opinion at the time. As I say, I want to emphasize that there was a companion opinion issued to us that did not contain that sort of language and that really we relied on. But no, I can't honestly sit here today and say I should have.
I think that's unfortunate, because it seems to me that language on a very straightforward reading is over the line. And that's what I think all of us wanted to hear, is that you wish you had objected.
So, in other words, what Wyden is saying is, does the United States have a moral compass? Are we going to be one of the moral leaders of the world? Are we going to be, in terms of, you know, effective interrogations, one of the leaders in that context? Because torture doesn't work in producing useful intelligence. It works in getting people to say anything they think you want them to say. But if you're looking for actual useful, actionable, real live, real world intelligence, serious interrogators long ago left behind torture. But there's this bizarre mentality in the Bush administration, which has now been picked up by countries all over the world, to say, yeah, no, it's fine. We'll just do this. We'll torture people, and or justifying it because they've been doing it for so long, just carrying on with it. In the meantime, Norman Podhertz has, if I'm pronouncing his name right, I'm not sure, has published this piece in one of the major conservative publications, which is really a pitch to the president, suggesting that we should be bombing Iran. This is a commentary magazine. and widely regarded as the leading outlet for neoconservative writing. It's a cover story by Norman Podhoretz, perhaps is how it's pronounced, The Case for Bombing Iran. And in this interview that's conducted with him afterwards, he says, you know, the question is, well, what kind of international fallout can we expect from such a campaign? See, he's pitching to the president that we should bomb Iran. And he says, well, if we were to bomb the Iranians, as I hope and pray we will, it'll unleash a wave of anti-Americanism all over the world that will make the anti-Americanism we've experienced so far look like a love fest. Huh? I mean, this is in the words of the guy who wrote the piece saying, well, apparently that's what they want. They want us to be hated. In today's Financial Times, the sort of the Wall Street Journal of the United Kingdom, and one of the things I find really interesting, I was staying at the Hilton Hotel here in Washington, D.C., and went into the concierge lounge, the 10th floor lounge, you know, for where you can get a free continental breakfast. And what newspaper are they giving away? And this is where, you know, most of the wealthy businessmen, you know, the whatnot, I got upgraded because of my frequent flyer status. But most people actually pay for, you know, a little extra for these rooms and have access to this. And the newspaper that they're passing out, the Financial Times, it's like people aren't even reading American papers anymore. I mean, it's people who are serious. Anyhow, in today's Financial Times commentary by Selig Harrison, The headline, Iran is America's best hope for stability in the Gulf. And this is from today's Financial Times. Iran is ready to help the U.S. stabilize both Iraq and Afghanistan, but only for a price, a gradual accommodation between Washington and Tehran, starting with a complete cessation of CIA and Pentagon covert operations designed to promote regime change. And then they go on talking about how there's this group, MEC, this terrorist group, that the State Department has classified as a terrorist group, that we are funding, that's doing black operations, you know, assassinations and things inside Iran. And Bush bragged about it in public. And in fact, one of the pullouts, one of the kind of subheads, large type things in this article in the Financial Times, it was naive for Bush to announce that $75 million was being funneled to Iranians, quote, seeking to promote openness, end quote. So, in other words, the international community is looking at this going, George, you are totally screwing this thing up. And at the same time, you got the neocons saying, yeah, let's go in and bomb them. It'll make everybody hate us even more. You want, what, five more 9/11s? Well, that'll do away with all civil liberties in America, which I think is their agenda. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Ooh-hoo. Ooh-hoo. Well, my heart knows it better than I know myself, so I'm gonna let it do all the talking. Ooh-hoo. Ooh-hoo. I came across a place in the middle of nowhere with a big black horse and a cherry tree. Ooh-hoo. Ooh-hoo. Felt a little fear upon my back. I said, don't look back, just keep on walking.
Keep moving ahead, keep moving ahead. Always, Jerome Ringo's with us with the Apollo Alliance, apolloalliance.org, the website. Jerome, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Hey, you're over at your website, apolloalliance.org, you're talking about green-collar jobs. This is something new in the lexicon. What's a green-collar job?
Well, we believe that when we strive to declare energy independence for America from foreign oil, we are going to create new jobs in America when we research and develop alternative energy like windmills and wind turbines and solar screens and hybrid cars. Is going to create a new economy for America and green jobs. It would be a new green economy.
Yeah, okay. How do we do this?
Well, when you talk about alternative energy, you're talking about, say, for example, wind turbines. Someone's going to have to develop those wind turbines, build them, install them, maintain them, That equates into jobs.
When those are green collar jobs. Sure, but the technology's out there right now. I mean, and it's improving every single day. One of the questions in my mind is, how do we keep that technology being manufactured in the United States, for example, if it's going to be consumed in the United States? Or are we simply going to see another, for example, you know, everybody was talking about when IBM came out with the PC back in, I think it was 83, the first IBM PC. Oh, this is incredible, and this is going to lead to an explosion of manufacturing, and there's going to be all these companies going to be springing up, and Silicon Valley is going to all, and for a while, it looked like that was the case, but I don't know if it's possible to find a computer made in the United States anymore. Is it going to be possible to find a wind turbine or a solar panel that's manufactured in the United States 5 years from now?
Absolutely. That is why it's important that we develop renewable portfolio standards or promote those standards in state legislatures around the country. For example, Pennsylvania now has passed a standard that 18% of the energy produced in this state be alternative energy. That creates opportunities to keep jobs in Pennsylvania. For example, Gamesa, which is a Spanish company that manufactures wind turbines, to take advantage of Pennsylvania's 18% law for alternative energy, moved its manufacturing facility to Pennsylvania and created 1,000 jobs.
Well, that's nice, but, you know, all the profit that company makes is not going to stay in the United States. It's going to go back to Spain. Why not have an American company do that?
Well, there will be American companies doing it. Gamesa took full advantage of it. But now we're seeing more and more American companies like General Electric and other companies that are interested in producing these products here in America. But even more than that, I'm from Louisiana, and we're seeing more ethanol plants being built in Louisiana because of the sugarcane availability, which is used as feedstock for ethanol. That sugarcane is grown in Louisiana. We won't ship that sugarcane to another country, because you can't transfer ethanol by pipeline. It picks up too much moisture. So therefore, the manufacturing facility must be near the feedstock source and must be near the distribution source, which stays in the community, in the state, and in the United States.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize that about ethanol.
Yes.
Does that mean that northern states that don't have the ability to grow things like sugarcane, for example, are going to have a challenge with ethanol?
No, it does not. What it means is that they can import the feedstock. They just need to be able to distribute the product close by. And so they can import the corn, if the corn is the base product, or if it's sugarcane as the base product, they can import those products as feedstock into their facilities. But on the back end, when they distribute it, they would be distributing within their communities or nearby.
Yeah, we're talking with Jerome Ringo. He's the president of the Apollo Alliance, apolloalliance.org, dedicated to making America energy independent. One of the most efficient, you know, since we're talking about biofuels here, one of the most efficient crops in terms of converting sunlight into fiber and, you know, the cellulose that can be used for presumably to produce ethanol, and particularly into oils that can be used to produce diesel fuel, is hemp. The Canadian government has legalized the growing of hemp, and they're producing biodiesel out of hemp, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of acres, perhaps millions of acres under cultivation there. It's being done all over the world. It's not still being done here in the United States. Are you guys taking this on?
Well, we're not taking it on in particular. What we're promoting is a diverse energy portfolio. We've been somewhat one-dimensional with respect to energy, mainly fossil fuel and coal. We think that there is a place within that portfolio for both of those, as long as they can be done environmentally friendly. Now, if hemp is a consideration as part of that portfolio, then that should be considered as well. We want to consider alternative energies, but make sure that those alternatives do not have adverse consequences, both to the environment or to the human health of people.
Yeah, okay. And to what specifically are you doing right now? We just got a couple of seconds left here, Jerome. Advancing legislation, are you mostly an advocacy group now?
We are advancing legislation, but we're also doing projects in cities like Oakland, California, to promote retrofitting. We are building the solar, working along the Gulf Coast to help build the Gulf Coast green from Hurricane Katrina.
That's great. Jerome Ringo, apolloalliance.org, the president of the Apollo Alliance. Thanks, Jerome.
Thank you.
Good having you on the program. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Nothing on but the radio. Feel the music playing soft and slow.
So Rob Portman decides he's going to leave the Bush administration. And again, an interesting analysis here from a couple of reporters in Washington, D.C., writing in the Financial Times. The surprise resignation is a blow to Mr. Bush as he struggles to push forward his policy agenda in the face of hostile Congress and slumping public approval ratings. Somehow it wasn't spun that way in America, in the American press, at least that I noticed. They go on to say the departures have added to the sense of weakening power that plagues the administration 18 months before Mr. Bush leaves office. Jim Nussel is the guy who's going to replace Rob Portman. And they make a point here that, again, it was probably reported, I just missed it, but that what Jim Nussel has been doing up until now is he's been an advisor to Rudy Giuliani. This is interesting. So Bush hires a Giuliani advisor to replace Rob Portman as his budget director? And what was particularly interesting was this comment by Portman about what was his major disappointment. And a second administration official acknowledged that Mr. Portman was, quote, extremely disappointed by what he views as the Democrats' failure to engage in a serious debate on entitlement reform, which, of course, is code for privatizing Social Security. I mean, you've got the Goldman Sachs lobby in the administration. You've got, our Secretary of the Treasury and others. They're all looking at all this. We're talking hundreds of billions of dollars here. And if you can do like they do with healthcare, in healthcare right now, private for-profit corporations skim 20 to 30% off the top of every single dollar that's spent for healthcare in the United States. Now, the Medicare system, if you go, you look at Medicare, the total cost of administration is under 3%, to like 2.8, 2.9%, depending on whose numbers you're using, more or less 3%. And that's the actual cost. So of every $100 in taxes that are collected that are used to pay for medical services under Medicare, $97 goes to pay for medical care, to actually provide medical services. But for every $100 collected in the private for-profit healthcare system in the United States, only $70 goes to pay for medical care. Where's the other $30 go? It goes for things like the $1.7 billion compensation package for William McGuire, the CEO of the second largest health insurance company in the country. It goes to pay for corporate jets. It goes to pay dividends to stockholders. It goes to pay for profits. It goes to pay for advertising and marketing. And on it goes. And so here, Rob Portman's saying, well, his biggest regret is that they didn't get to do to Social Security what we've already done to health care. Brilliant. Eric in New York. Hey, Eric, welcome to the program. Eric?
Tom? Hey, Tom.
Yeah, you're on the air. I'm great. What's up?
I just wanted to throw a couple of points out about what you were talking about with Jerome Ringo. First of all, industrial hemp, which is what Canada allows to be grown, doesn't actually have any PCPs in it. So when he was talking about health risks to humans, I assume he was talking about people possibly smoking.
Yeah, I think he was just being very, very cautious. And it's THC, not PCP.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, it would have, I mean, you'd have to...
Tetrahydrocannabinols.
Yeah, exactly. And the other thing is, I think you make a great point in... I mean, I think he makes a great point in the fact that a perfect example is your own hometown of Portland, which is, one of the cities that's actually signed on to the Kyoto Agreement. And
yeah,
the economy is booming as a result of everybody turning over to green energy and renewable fuels and renewable...
And we're meeting the Kyoto standards. We're absolutely meeting the Kyoto standards, and that's a city. Bill Richardson, in his talk yesterday at the Take Back America conference, he said that the entire state of New Mexico has exceeded Kyoto standards. Kyoto is just a very, very small first step. But Eric, thanks for the call. Good point and well made. Dorothea in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Dorothea.
Hi there. Glad to talk with you.
Thank you.
What I wanted to bring up is, if I had a question for all the candidates, would be, will you bring the United States into the International Criminal Court? Will you join the criminal court? Because impeachment, obviously, most Americans want this, but it's not going to happen, and this Bush crime family needs to pay.
Well, and it's not just the Bushes. I mean, it goes beyond that. But it does. Yeah, I don't disagree with you, and we are not getting that. That issue is not being raised. That's a good one, and hopefully that question will be being raised. And if I have an opportunity to raise it with any candidates, I will do so. Dorothea, thank you very much for the call. Our number 1-866-303-2270. And if you want to drop into our live chat room, you can go over to airamerica.com, click Tom Hartman and Tom Hartman page, and there's a link directly to it. Or you can go to tomhartman.com and click live chat. Patrick in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Patrick, what's on your mind today?
Yes, hi. I'm calling from Pittsburgh, who our city last month was voted the most livable city in America. We have no steel mills for 20 years. It's another bright, beautiful day here. And this is the home of St. John Newman, the Merton Center, Don't Call Me Boss, Davy Lawrence, and we have a 27-year-old
That's a great city.
Mayor, and also O'Neill, the former Secretary of Treasury.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I'm calling. I just got this double disc of The Scream by Wallace Shawn, and it has everything to do with torture and how a person raised with values, once they know what the face of torture is, deals with it. And it astounded me, and it was done in 1990, and now Vanessa Redgrave, I understand, is going to be in a movie of The Scream. And I was wondering if you're familiar with it, but if you're not. It's available on Shout, is the label, and it's shout.com.
So this is a commercial DVD? It's like a movie?
Well, no, it's not a movie. It's the audio of him doing this monologue, and it's two discs. And it's astounding.
Yeah.
It shook me up.
Yeah. I'm not familiar with it, Patrick, but I will start keeping an eye out for it now. And thank you for, thanks for the heads up. I appreciate it. Jack in Wisconsin. Hey, Jack, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hey, Jack.
Yeah, okay. Couple comments. I wanted to talk about why I'm in favor of a single-payer program. I'm a
single-payer healthcare.
Yeah. I'm a clinical social worker. I work with treatment foster care right now. I got a first raise, you know, in how many years of $100 net. When I turned 55, I lost $65 of that just simply because my premium went up, my share of paying towards the cost. And then I was just informed that my agency had to renegotiate again for health care. You know, we get, you know, okay coverage, but it went up 18%. And that means compared to January 1st, I'm now paying $8 more out of my paycheck than I did, you know, December 31st.
Right. This 30% profit overhead for the for-profit health insurance industry in the United States is really an enormous tax on the American people, so that a small number of very wealthy corporations and a very small number of very well-compensated CEOs, I think, you know, Bill McGuire is the poster boy of the whole thing with his $1.7 billion paycheck, but it's a tax on us.
Well, see, like my wife says, you know, you shouldn't be making profit off of sick people. Everybody should get their wage and salary and dealing with this whole thing. And the only way we're going to control it is by having a cost of living increase for all the people up and down the thing and getting them all out. It's a common good. Now, here's another thing. When I've heard people talk about this issue, you know, we need a whole different kind of economic way of theory. Capitalism is maximized profit. How about optimizing profit where the common good is weighed equally against a person's individual right to make money.
Right. See, that's called regulated capitalism, and that's what we had in the United States from the arguably 1934, 1935, thereabouts, through the early 1980s when Reagan started deregulating everything and stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. We've gone in this country back and forth. It's a seesaw, literally from the founding of this country, back and forth. We've gone through about four major cycles of having, on the one hand, mostly regulated capitalism versus, on the other hand, mostly unregulated or laissez-faire capitalism. And what we find is that when we have regulated capitalism, we have a strong middle class, and the economy grows, and our manufacturing base grows, and things work very well, and we don't have the emergence of dynastic families. If you look at these periods of time, from the 1930s to the 1980s, for example, or from the 1770s up until the Civil War, arguably the 1840s, you look at those, or when Teddy Roosevelt was doing his trust busting from 1900 to arguably 1915. For all practical purposes, no dynastic families emerged during that time. There were no giant institutions that emerged that had such enormous wealth and power that they could basically seize control of the government. On the other hand, if you look at the times when it was absolutely unregulated and there was no controls on it, then you have that's when the Rockefellers and the DuPonts and the Morgans and all the names that we're all familiar with, that's when those dynasties emerged. Ultimately, at the end of the day, and it's also when the middle class got destroyed. And ultimately, at the end of the day, I don't think it's good for American democracy. Your point is well made, Doug, and I thank you for calling and making it. We have to ask the question, is an economy here to serve society, or are we, the members of society, here to serve whoever is the most powerful within the economy? And, you know, that basically is where the split breaks down. And as I said, we've gone back and forth and back and forth, and what we find is that the times that democracy is the most vibrant in the United States is the time when economic power is most widely distributed. It's 46 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Now back to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
I don't want to fight for curious George Bush and his friends. Sold us this war. Till they get those oil fields, they're gonna sell us some more. Well, Katrina came, Katrina went. The money we need has all been spent. New Orleans and Baghdad, it's all the same. And the contracts are written in Halliburton's name. It's the same old blues, Republican blues.
But that's coming to an end, I'm telling you. It is coming to an end. Welcome back. Nine minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C., on the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
You're still over at the conference.
Still there, grinding to a halt.
Yeah, first of all, I know you've had a couple of interesting interviews here today that you wanted to talk about, but I'm curious about your take on, I was there this morning for Hillary Clinton's speech. I'm curious about your take on it, particularly after the conversation that we had yesterday about Barack Obama and John Edwards' speeches.
Well, I think she did very well. I mean, I think she came in third. I think it was inevitable that she came in third because I think she's seen as more of a centrist. But even with the boo, I think she did very, very well.
Yeah. The thing that occurred to me is, I mean, she got a number of standing ovations. She got a lot of applause. She got a lot. I was frankly surprised by the intensity of the pro-Hillary Clinton faction there, you know, among the, you know, this conference for the most progressive people in America. And there was that one moment where she basically said that the Iraqi government has failed to fulfill their obligations, as if that's, you know, the cause of all the problems, and she got booed. I thought it was a dumb line. I thought it was
very
just,
dumb.
You know, it was just, you know, whoever wrote her speech should never have included. It was a stupid sentence. It shouldn't have been in there. And if it hadn't been in there, she could have gotten through the entire speech without being booed. Number one, and number two, I thought, at the end of the day, that's going to be the only thing that anybody's talking about. And really, I think that's unfortunate.
I agree. I think it is unfortunate. And it is, to a great extent, what people are talking about. I can tell you, because that's what people have been talking to me about.
Yeah.
And so
I thought her metaphor of the invisible Americans was a marvelous one.
It was terrific, and it's not going to get coverage.
Yeah, it's unfortunately. So anyhow, so you talked to Howard Dean and Jesse Jackson this morning.
Talked to Howard Dean, Jesse Jackson. Jesse was not in a wildly, he's speaking right now actually, he was not in a wildly communicative mood. I mean, sometimes, you know, you wind him up and he just goes.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll go for hours. And today he didn't. He spoke in concise, clear, brief sentences, so you had to keep asking him questions. But he talked about domestic terror. That was his thing. He talked about Iraq, obviously, but he talked about domestic terror, and he talked about drugs and guns coming into the country. And this
well, we've had domestic terror for a long, long time in this country. It's typically been called the Ku Klux Klan.
Right. Right.
Is that what he was talking about?
No, his definition of domestic terror right now is drugs and guns coming into the country.
Oh, interesting. But we make a lot of that stuff domestically. I mean, most of the meth, I think, sold in the United States is made here.
He's talking about
and most
cocaine.
Of the guns sold
He's
are made
talking about
here.
Cocaine and opium.
Yeah. So
that was
he's seeing these as problems, not as symptoms of problems.
Well,
I mean, I see these as
that.
Symptoms of poverty, frankly.
Well, I said, you know, people want to take drugs.
Right.
He didn't.
And
answer
he said,
that. "Well, he didn't really answer that. He moved on to something else."
Yeah. Okay.
There isn't an answer to that.
Yeah. Okay.
And Howard Dean's thing was more. We talked about Iraq to a great extent, obviously, but we did talk about healthcare also, and he was talking about a healthcare plan which would involve a Medicare-type system of coverage for everybody under 25, and then bringing down the age of Medicare from 65 to 55, and then covering everybody in increments down from that to 45 to 35, and then down to 25, so that everybody would be covered by a Medicare-type system. And I said, so you're talking about, you know, government-funded healthcare, in fact. And he said, yeah, I am.
Yeah, Medicare for all, basically.
Basically Medicare for all, that's what he's talking about.
Yeah. Which is what John Edwards, by the way, is suggesting. That's at the basis of his program, is that everybody can buy into Medicare. Let Medicare compete in the private, you know, in the marketplace. And of course, you know, they'll win the competition because they don't have to pay dividends to stockholders. You know, it is exploding the myth that the private marketplace can do things more efficiently than government. Obviously, there are a lot of things it does more efficiently than government, but there are many things that it doesn't do more efficiently, particularly those things that have to do with the commons and life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the general welfare of the people. What else is going on at the conference here? There were high points in the last 24 hours, things that I might have missed?
I don't think you missed very much. I mean, there was the dinner last night. Did you go to that?
I did. It was very nice. I thought in particular the analogy between bloggers and, you know, going back to the early American bloggers, the pamphleteers, which frankly I recall, you know, right through the 60s and 70s, was a great analogy. And it boggles my mind that there's all these guys out here, particularly on the right, you know, Fox News and whatnot, but also in the mainstream media, peddling the idea that bloggers are somehow toxic.
Isn't that interesting that they're doing that? There must be some kind of threat there. I mean, they wouldn't be otherwise, would they?
Clearly there is. I mean, the mainstream media has been falling down on the job, and they're getting more and more right wing. And CNN was supposed to be a news channel, and they've got commentary on there, and it's not just commentary; it's right wing commentary. Glenn Beck, that's not news. Come on, give me a break.
I know Glenn Beck says horrendous.
I know it's tragic, and it's just one of several. I mean, you know, it's and MSNBC doing the same thing, you know, and putting on, with the singular exception of Keith Olbermann, who's absolutely brilliant and the one, I think, shining voice out there in the television landscape. It's basically all right wing all day long, and so, gee, what a surprise! And alternative media emerges from the grassroots. Could it be a symptom of a need?
I think so.
Yeah, so. The straw poll, any sense of how the straw poll is doing?
No, it closed around noon, and we have no results in yet.
Okay, well,
very
when
intrigued.
You get them, yeah, when you get them, let us know. Good talking with you, Victoria, and it was great spending the last couple of days hanging out and in your presence. It's great,
it was fun
to see you again.
It was fun. Good to see you.
I agree. Okay. I'll look forward to it again. Victoria Jones, the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program right here on Air America Radio. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio. To the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. You know, it should have been the lead story. It should have been at the top of the New York Times. It should have been the top of the Washington Post. It should have been the top of newspapers nationwide. Well, for that matter, it should have been the lead story on the front page of the labor section of every one of the newspapers, all the local and national newspapers, except that we don't have labor sections in our newspapers anymore, tragically. We have business sections, no problem. Interests of the business community, well covered. But labor, not. Ever since Ronald Reagan came into office and declared war on organized labor, we have seen some real challenges for working people in the United States. And finally we have a Congress that is willing to at least discuss and perhaps even act on pushing back. John Sweeney is with us. He's the president of the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.com, the website. President Sweeney, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. I'm really delighted to be on the program.
Well, I'm pleased that you're there doing the great work that you've been doing for so many years. And this, the Employee Free Choice Act, this could be a major issue. The last time you and I talked, I think it was almost a year ago, and I pointed out that I've been ranting for years that we need to roll back Taft-Hartley. Is this the beginning of it?
Yeah, I think it is. It's really this is the strongest middle-class supporting piece of legislation that Congress has considered in decades, and the Employee Free Choice Act is really the way to make sure that a union card is our nation's best anti-poverty device.
Yeah, I saw a right-wing commentator last week, I think it was, on I don't remember the channel or you know what I was watching, but he just, like in passing, said, and can you believe it? They're actually going to, they're considering passing legislation so that people can just join a union by marking, you know, signing a postcard.
Yeah.
And, as if it was some sort of horrible, outrageous thing.
I know.
It's like, wait a minute, this is unions are democracy in the workplace. We should be enthusiastic about this.
They're scared to death. But this is one way to really make it fairer for workers to be able to express themselves as to whether they want a union or they don't want a union, and to be able to do it in an expeditious way. Right now we're seeing presently this 31,000 cases pending from last year before the National Labor Relations Board of workers who were either fired or terminated or harassed because they had expressed a desire to join a union.
And now we have a National Labor Relations Board that's stacked with anti-labor people by the Bush administration.
They're not just anti-labor, they're inexperienced, don't know the labor laws, and it's a disgrace to see an agency like that becoming so political.
Yeah, indeed. Among others. I mean, we're seeing this right across the board. This is so...
Oh, sure.
You know, this is part of Karl Rove's plan to have a 100-year single-party rule, Republican majority for 100 years. I think that they, in the Soviet Union, they used to call that the Politburo.
Yes. And but, that's, you know, we're seeing the same thing with the appointments to the courts.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly my point. The Employee Free Choice Act is, give me a quick snapshot of exactly what the Employee Free Choice Act encompasses.
Well, the Employee Free Choice Act would give workers a free and fair chance to form unions, as I just said. It does three things. It strengthens penalties for companies that coerce or intimidate workers. It establishes a mediation and binding arbitration process when the employer and workers cannot agree on the first contract. And it allows workers the right to exercise their freedom to form a union when a majority sign cards authorizing the union to bargain on their behalf. And it's just basically restoring human rights to workers who want to express themselves and whether they join a union or not.
Yesterday there was a big rally here in Washington, D.C. I'm broadcasting from Washington, D.C. today. But I was doing my show from the Take Back America conference and just, you know, got wrapped up in the million details around that and was unable to participate. How did it go?
Oh, it was great. I mean, we had about 5,000 people there from all across the country. We had a number of senators supporting the legislation at the rally, including Senator Reid and Senator Kennedy and several others, and of course we had a number of major union leaders, and we had workers who had testified about what happened when they tried to form unions, and we also heard from our allies in the civil rights movement as well as the women's movement and the environmental community, and it was a great rally.
We're talking with John Sweeney, the president of the AFL-CIO, AFL-CIO.com, of course, their website. And what do you think, President Sweeney, what do you think the chances of the passage of this are, A, and B, what do you think the chances of, given that Bush just vetoed the stem cell bill, which has, I mean, huge support among the American public, this might seem a little more obscure than that. To the average person, tragically, again, because our media has so utterly failed over the last 25, 30 years to cover labor issues. But nonetheless, this might even be a harder veto to override. What do you think?
Well, I think that, as you know, of course, the legislation passed the House by a wide margin. And as you're saying, the Senate is obviously a tougher battle. We expect to have a majority in the Senate support the legislation. And this is something that was almost inconceivable a few years ago. If we don't garner enough support to overcome a filibuster, we believe that the momentum is on our side for the long-term fight, and workers will continue to make it clear that the Employee Free Choice Act is one of their top priorities, and it's certainly going to be a top priority in 2008 and beyond. And so we're prepared for whatever process it takes to get this accomplished.
Like, it sounds like what you're saying is that there's a chance, there's a possibility or a probability that the Republicans will prevent there from even being an up-and-down vote on this in the Senate?
Well, there'll be a vote on the filibuster issue, and The vote that we don't think we'll achieve right now is a vote to overturn a veto. If it we would need 60 votes, and
right.
we're going to have to change a few more senators as we did in the last election in order to achieve that.
Yeah. So, but we're still. Are there undecideds out there? Are there particular senators that our listeners should be calling right now and saying, "Please vote for the Employee Free Choice Act"?
Yes, there are, and that there are, some moderate Republicans, depending on how much pressure they get from the White House, will determine whether they. Whether they vote in favor or against, but since we're lobbying these folks and trying to turn some of these votes around, I'd rather not get into the specific names.
Sure. Yeah. No, I understand. It can be a delicate thing, but it is. I'm assuming okay for me to suggest to my listeners that just right across the board, from coast to coast. I mean, our program is on the air from literally from Los Angeles to New York and lots of places in between. That people be calling their senators, both of theirs, unless they live in Washington, D.C., everybody has two senators, call both of them, Democratic or Republican, and just say, the Employee Free Choice Act is important to me and my family. Don't just vote for it. Lobby your colleagues for it if you're already in favor of it.
And that's what we're encouraging people who not just union members, but people who support the rights of workers to be calling their senators and to call Democrats and thank them for what they're doing, and to urge Republicans to support it as well. This is This is really shouldn't be a partisan political issue. This is about basic human rights for workers who want to have representation and want to have collective bargaining.
Well, and tragically, it's also about a majority. I mean, if there's a majority vote for this in the Senate already, I mean, what happened to the Republican mantra of we want an up-and-down vote?
Right,
you know, right. It's just incredible. John Sweeney, president of the AFL-CIO, AFLCIO.com, the website. John Sweeney, President Sweeney, thanks so much for being with us today.
And thanks for giving me the opportunity. Thank you.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Keep up the great work. It's 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio.
Hartman Program, transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Broadcasting live today from Washington, D.C., and with a special call-out and thanks to the folks at XM who are allowing us to use their studios today. And Ben, who's sitting here with me, engineering the thing and making it all work. Thank you, Ben. Linda in Florida, you're on the air. Hey, Linda, what's up?
Thank you for the information you've been giving about the unions. Sir, I want to ask you, the Psychiatric Association and the pharmaceutical companies have 10 to 1 lobbyists for their pharmaceuticals. It sounds to me like the old people on Medicare with this bill that we were talking about earlier, they need unions to protect them from being drugged into oblivion, which our children are being put on Prozac and Ritalin in the millions. There's mass shootings. Every single one of them have been cases of children being put on antidepressants. And that has been deemed that the ADDHs that children are labeled, even screening teens and putting them on drugs, and old people and children from 2 months old. These are the psychiatrists and the pharmaceuticals possibly backing this bill because they have the big money.
I get it, Linda, that you're concerned about the overuse of psychiatric medications,
and I am
as well. I'm not opposed to psychiatric medications per se, but I think that it's a significant problem in the United States that we need to be addressing, and I've written seven books on the topic. But I don't get your point about unions. Or were you just trying to pull two threads together to make a point?
It is an intertwined. Poor old people don't have any rights at all. And the unions, the teachers' union, for instance, I've heard teachers call in and talk about how they're coerced into paying dues with into the teachers' union, or they're extricated, or they're, you know.
Well, if you're working in a closed shop environment, then you have to join the union, and the reason why is really simple, because you all get the benefits of the union. It's just like you and I. You said, "Where's the union for old people?" The union for old people is called the United States of America. It's called democracy. Unions are simply democratic institutions. They're mini democracies. They happen to exist in the context of workplaces. The major democracy exists in the United States of America. And so, just like you and I are members of the United States of America, we're members of this union, this national union. In fact, it was referred to very often by the founders as a union of states. And therefore, there are certain things we have to do. We have to pay taxes. Because we derive benefit from being a member of this union of the United States. And so in a closed shop, if you're deriving the benefits of being in the closed shop, if you're deriving the pay increases and the vacations and the protections of the union, you get to pay for it as well. And I think it's a fine thing. I have no problem with it at all. But Linda, thank you for the call and for making your point. Jake in San Francisco. Hey, Jake, what's up?
Thing I want to say, Tom, is I wanted to let you know how much I appreciate your brilliance. You illuminate so much and provide so much context and detail and set of facts to things that others don't.
Thank you for your kind words, Jack.
I There are a couple of things, if there's time, I don't know how much time we'll have, that I'd like to talk about. Well, one of them is something that I don't think has been addressed in the way I see it with regard to Hillary Clinton. I'm not a Hillary Clinton disliker. What I'm about to say has to do with a set of facts. When she voted against the war, and she says that, you know, she doesn't want to essentially discuss that any further, what she's doing and what the public is allowing is to obscure a set of individual decisions that other people at the time that she voted were getting accurately, as we now look with hindsight, about the war. In other words,
you're talking actually about when she voted for authorizing Bush to use force. Is that what you're talking
about? Yes.
Okay, because you said when she voted against the war. I thought you were talking about her most recent vote.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I was not clear about that. For example, in the beginning, at that time, 10 to 20% in the polls of people said the following things. Not all of them got everything right, but many of them said all of these things, and she got each one of them wrong. For example, they said, we should not go into Iraq because Afghanistan is the target. They said, there were no weapons of mass destruction there. They said, if we go in there, it will cause a quagmire.
There were many of us who were saying, even if there are weapons of mass destruction there, he has no way of delivering them to us. There's probably 100 countries in the world that have weapons of mass destruction. Does that mean we've got a list?
They said, exactly.
A hit list?
They said that there would be a quagmire there. They said that it would become a magnet for terrorists. They said it would spread the war in the Middle East. They said each one of these things. Now, yeah. Those things.
Well, and they were right, and Hillary was wrong on that vote. And since that time, I mean, this is, I think the interesting, the New York Times is talking about this today, that last year when she spoke at this Take Back America conference, she was loudly and roundly booed. And last year she was still defending her vote. This year she has now voted against the supplemental appropriation. And Jake, thanks a lot for your call. We've got to take a break here at the bottom of the hour. But this year she voted against the supplemental, and she's speaking out against the war, and she's talking about bringing people back rapidly. And frankly, other than, you know, what I thought was just a dumb line in her speech that seemed to imply that the Iraqis were somehow responsible for the mess in Iraq, she's taking a more progressive position, shall we say.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
We're not gonna take it. We ain't gonna take it. We're not gonna take it anymore.
No, sirree, Bob. We're not going to take it anymore. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Gary in Corydon, Indiana. Hey, Gary, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. The question I have for you, because you're a lot smarter than I am. I remember on the Ring of Fire program, Mike Papantonio and Bobby Kennedy were talking about they had filed some kind of RICO thing about the voting machines. Against the voting machine companies.
Yeah.
And what I wondered, I mean, you know, can't a regular everyday person file against the RNC for all this, caging and everything else they've been doing? I mean, aren't they under a court order not to do that?
Yeah, the Republican Party has been under court order since the late 70s, I believe, to not engage in caging and other forms of vote fraud that they have conducted in the past. With regard to individuals and what they can do, frankly, Gary, I don't know. You know, speaking of smarter, Mike and Bobby are a whole lot smarter than I am. I mean, these guys are both lawyers, and they really know this topic. And I'm not an attorney, and I've read the RICO laws and have some broad familiarity with them, but I don't know if any of us could individually do it. The larger issue, though, and Gary, thanks for your call. The larger issue is one that, you know, I brought up, I think, yesterday with Susie Turnbull from the vice chair of the Democratic National Committee. And that is that if we agree, if we collectively, we the people of the United States agree, or frankly of any democracy, if we agree that the whole point of having a democratic government, small d democratic government, having a republic, if you want to go along with the right-wing talking points, so it sounds more like Republican, whatever. If we agree that the purpose of having a government is to administer and care for the commons, the things that are absolutely essential, so essential that we would never want to put them in private hands where somebody might say, aha, you really want some water? I'll just triple the price. Or, you think that you should have clean air to breathe? You know, who said that? You know, or a species? Whatever it may be. That there are this thing called the commons, our air, our water, the quality of our food, the purity of our food, the purity of our drugs, the safety of our streets, our police departments, our ability to be protected from fire, our fire departments, street lights. I mean, all this stuff. This is the commons. This is why we have government. We all agree on this. Even conservatives agree on this, by and large. I mean, they'll say, you know, some parts of government shouldn't exist. We shouldn't have public education, for example. They don't think that's part of the commons. They would never agree that health care should be part of the commons. I think both are part of the commons. Frankly, I think college education should be part of the commons. But those are minor disagreements. We all agree, however, on the idea, everybody in America, by and large, agrees on the idea that there is this thing called the commons that at the very least, I mean, even the Ayn Rand folks, even the ultra-libertarian objectivists would say, well, there's at least the commons of the law that allows corporations to conduct the business, right, that allows capital to form together into a limited liability corporation. So if we all agree that there is this thing called the commons that is so vital that we're never going to hand it into the hands of a private corporation because they could do us serious harm. They could do our democracy serious harm. We all agree on that. And the instrument that we use to control that commons, to make sure that everything really is protected like that and really does work, is called government. And we all agree on that. Then why? Why would we hand the beating heart of government, of democracy, the vote, over to a private corporation? If it would be a crime to privatize, for example, our legal system, our laws, if it would be a crime to privatize our judicial system, our courts, if it would be a crime to privatize our public education system, if it would be a crime, you know, these are all arguably, many of these would even be small crimes against democracy. You know, privatizing Yellowstone, let's sell it to Disney. But privatizing the vote? Why are people not talking about this? I don't get this. Sometimes I think it's like I'm either missing something huge or I'm all alone out here in the wilderness. You've got people running around, you know, Rush Holt, talking with his bill about, and I had this conversation with him 3 years ago on this radio program. Running around saying, well, you know, I'm a physicist, I got a PhD in physics, I know all about this kind of stuff, and we're going to make sure that we get these voting machines secure. And I'm like, but as long as they're owned and programmed by private corporations who claim that we, the people, don't have the right to look at the software, you've privatized our vote. That's wrong. And now Dianne Feinstein's come along with, frankly, an even worse bill than Rush Holt's. And everybody is arguing about, are they secure? Are they not secure? I don't care if they're secure or not secure. I do care, obviously, but my real concern is this is the ultimate in the commons. It's the beating heart of democracy. It's our vote. And we're giving it to a corporation called Diebold. We're giving that whose former president, Wally O'Dell, says, you know, I'm going to give Ohio to George W. Bush. We're giving it to a corporation like ES&S, who used to be run by Chuck Hagel, the Republican senator from Nebraska. I mean, well, enough said. That should be the meme. We need to be talking about the privatization of our vote. Just like we, instead of calling it a war in Iraq, we should call it an occupation, because occupations appropriately come to an end, and wars appropriately are won or lost, and we're not going to win or lose in Iraq. We simply need to end the occupation. We already won the war. We took down Saddam's government. Similarly, we need to change the frame and the language around the voting, the whole voting issue, and change it from, are the machines safe or are they not, quack, 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 to, why are we privatizing our vote? People say, well, back in the 64 election was the first time you had machines. They were these lever pull machines. Or actually, before that, 1960. Yes, they were machines, but but they were owned by government. We owned them. You could take the back panel off and you could look at the gears. You could see how they worked. They were transparent. It's a world of difference. A world of difference. So, anyhow, that's my bottom line on that. Ruth in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Ruth, what's up?
Hi. I want to reiterate your former caller there. I appreciate all the work that you do, and I think that you're brilliant at what you do, and we need you so badly. But, you know, I have an issue, and I see it on this station a lot, with the illegal situation. And when you put Mr. Sweeney up there, I worked for Proposition 200. I was the assistant to the chairman. And the AFL-CIO took us to court, along with the Chamber of Commerce and the other pro-illegal.
If I may interrupt you, Ruth, I don't know what Proposition 200 is. This was an Arizona proposition?
Correct. Okay. And
it did what?
Yeah, it was basically to stop non-American citizens or illegals to not receiving welfare benefits, food stamps, medical, and things like that. Well, the AFL-CIO took us to court to stop that at a tune of $100,000. Mm-hmm. Now, you need to ask yourself, why is the union so pro-illegal? What do you think that answer is?
Well, I think the answer is fairly straightforward, and it's one of a very small number of areas where I disagree with both the AFL-CIO and SEIU and the whole Change to Win coalition. I disagree right across the board with most of the union movement, and that is that they're saying, you know, there's going to be an amnesty, and these people are potential union members.
Correct.
I suppose in a very practical sense, they're right. I think that they're shooting themselves in the foot, frankly, but that's, you know, it's a whole other conversation. But, you know, that's what they're doing, and that's the political equation. But, you know, and I appreciate your comment and your call, Ruth, and your sentiment. The bottom line, though, is no democratic institution is perfect. And a union is a democratic institution. It can't do what its members don't want done. I mean, if the president of a union consistently does things that the members don't want, he or she will be voted out. It's real simple. And you know, the unions are taking the positions they're taking, and they're doing the things that they're doing as democratic institutions, and I have to respect that, just like I have to respect, you know, American democracy. I think we all do. And frankly, I would rather see a strong union movement in the United States taking positions on a few issues on which I disagree than no union movement in the United States, or a weak union movement in the United States, for that matter. Don in Memphis. Hey, Don, we've got about a half a minute here before we have to take a break. What's up?
Good afternoon. I would like your take on the information that Tony Snow gave, that they did use the RNC computers, I believe, in violation of the Hatch Act. Didn't he just out the Bush administration to criminal charges?
He said that they did it to avoid violations of the Hatch Act, and he said that the Clinton administration did it too, and he lied.
He did lie, yes. I mean,
it's really simple. He didn't admit to anything criminal, but he lied, in my opinion.
Well, just the fact that they use the RNC computers for business, isn't that in violation of the Hatch Act?
Yes and no. If the RNC was archiving anything that went through it in ways that were consistent with the Presidential Records Act, then it would not be a violation of the Hatch Act, I don't think. But as it is, or actually, the Hatch Act, the Presidential Records Act, yeah. But that's not what they did. Instead, they deleted hundreds of thousands of records of emails from 51 different people in the executive branch. You know, people who were supposed to be doing the people's business, but instead were working towards 100 years of single-party rule. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I ain't lived forever, but I've lived enough. And I've learned to be gentle, and I've learned to be tough. I found only two things that last till the end. One is your heroes, the other's your friends.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour.
You find
Hey, we have a great post over at airamerica.com/Tom Hartman page, or the Tom Hartman page blog over at airamerica.com. And so our selected post of the day by David Poole, our producer, is from Blue in Missouri, Blue in MO. And Blue's blog post says, "Wow, what a concept." It's headlined Employee Free Choice Act. "Wow, what a concept. Can you imagine democracy in the workplace in America? My mother taught me if someone is offering something for free, beware. But the Employee Free Choice Act is one free thing I would like to own. I would get to decide if I get good health care and good wages or no health care and slave wages. Decisions, what's a girl to choose?" Yeah. And then she adds a link to the Employee Free Choice Act, 10 key facts you need to know. It's a link over to AFL-CIO.org. I kept saying .com, and I had it written down here as .com. I hopefully they have both domains. Anyhow, she's doing .org. So anyhow, thank you very much and congratulations. Well done. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Steve in Mountain View, California. Hey, Steve. Steve?
Controls on the...
Steve, you want to start again? I missed the first part
you
said.
Just as there have to be controls on capitalism for it to work properly, I'm a little concerned about there have to be controls on the unions. I'm of a generation from Southeast Michigan that got wiped out by the auto unions in my generation. We all got out of high school in the late 70s, and we all had to go to Texas, Florida, or California to get work because there was no work.
Let me just get something straight here. You and I grew up in pretty much the same area. I grew up in Lansing, Michigan,
right.
And in fact, we lived in Detroit for a while. Our oldest child was born in Livonia Hospital. We were living in Westland at the time, and Detroit suburb. And my dad worked at Lansing Dye Sinking and Lansing Tool and Dye, two tool and dye shops. Worked at Lansing Tool and Dye, I forget which one. Yeah, Lansing Tool and Dye for like 40 years, right? And, you know, a good union job, and two of my three brothers are members of unions in Michigan right now. One's a union printer and the other's a union electrician. And my recollection of what happened in Michigan, and I'd say most of my friends, because I grew up in a very, you know, blue-collar neighborhood, and most of my friends' parents worked at the Oldsmobile factory. My recollection of what happened was that General Motors decided, particularly you're talking about Pontiac, and go up north there a little bit to Flint, General Motors decided that they were going to move either 5 or 10 factories, I think it was 5, out of Flint and relocate them to Mexico. Now, you're telling me that was the fault of the union?
No, that part obviously that was GM.
That's what wiped out the auto. You know, that plus just absolutely, totally screwed up, stupid decisions being made by management about what kind of cars to offer in the marketplace. So the Japanese came in and ate their lunch, combined with trade policies on the part of Japan, where, you know, they had an export-driven trade policy and we had basically no trade policy at all in the United States. I would say that's what killed the auto industry. The unions were simply there advocating for their workers.
Well, I watched Roger and Me, and my brother lives in Flint, and I don't have any argument with that. But there was my brother went to U of M and paid for his college by working at the Ford vinyl plant. And they had fellows who would come in and fall asleep all day under their workbenches because they couldn't get them out because the union was protecting them. So there were some abuses there as well.
No, we all know stories like that, and I agree. And those are the kinds of things that need to be pointed out and need to be fixed. But I'll tell you know, having been around unions and union shops my whole entire life, and it sounds like you are too. I'm guessing that you have to agree with me that that's the exception, not the rule.
Yeah, that's what I was. That's actually the point I was trying to make. Is I'm not anti-union. I'm just saying that if you like anything else, if it's unregulated, it tends to, you know, it tends towards abuse.
Yeah, and you know, by and large, unions typically tend to be internally regulating, but that's one of the reasons. I mean, you know, is there was also a large contingent of organized crime that infiltrated the union movement back in the 50s and 60s, and you know, the federal government had to step in. Just like with any other institution, it's imperfect people, imperfect institutions.
Yeah,
I don't disagree that there needs to be some regulation of unions, but what we have right now is a war on unions, and that's a whole different thing. It's just a whole different thing. Steve, thanks for the call, but good point. Anthony in Seattle. Hey, Anthony, got about a minute before we've got to wrap
Tom.
This show up.
I just wanted to first give a shout-out to my local Air America station, AM 1090, and they're going to be out this weekend at Gay Pride, and they are every year, and I just want to thank them for participating. A couple callers ago, you had a guy from Indiana inquiring about the caging, essentially what happened on Monday was that the Senate Judiciary Committee, Sheldon Whitehouse and Ted Kennedy, sent a letter, and they CC'd it to, you know, the Justice Department and the Office of Special Counsel and all that. They're inquiring. Believe me, they're on the case of the caging.
Yeah. Yeah, because I got it. And in fact, we talked about that on the program. And this is the first time, frankly, that I've heard any members of Congress talking about caging. And I'm so pleased. So thanks a lot for the call. Great to hear from you. Tomorrow, I'm boogieing out to the airport, heading back home tonight. We'll be back tomorrow live from Portland, Oregon, from our home studio at KPOJ. And look forward to seeing you then. And don't forget, my friends. Don't ever forget. I mean, this is the key to it all. Democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.